My sister's the only one ever writes. I don't even know where any of them are now, except her and Ma.
Are they well?
Elsa said. It was a silly thing to say, but she didn't want him to stop talking about them. They must be, the way their appetites hold out.
You mean you support them?
No. They pull the hard luck story out of the bag about half a dozen times a year, and I send them something.
I shouldn't think they'd have the nerve after the way they treated you.
He was amused. They treated me all right. Where'd you get that idea?
But you ran away from home.
I ran away from the old man, Bo said. He's been dead for 10 years.
Oh.
She couldn't think of anything else to ask him, and they stood in the room's heat, looking at each other. Mr. Blake stuck his gray head through the window, looked around, pulled it back in with a slow munching of toothless jaws. Bo put out a hand and touched her fur collar.
"Thanks," he said. "You're a sport. I haven't felt as good as this for 2 weeks. That feud was getting my goat."
"Me too," she said, and blushed.
"Where you headed?"
"I was going over to Helms and give her a loaf of fresh bread," she said, and lifted the newspaper-wrapped parcel under her arm.
"I got something to show you."
He regarded her abstractly, his tongue in the corner of his mouth.
"You run on over and I'll bust past the hotel and get it and see you at Helms. How's that?"
"Good."
She smiled at him, couldn't keep the smile from breaking into a laugh.
"I'm so glad we've quit fighting," she said,
and started back along the sidewalk. She had gone only a dozen steps when her hat was knocked over her eye by a large, soft snowball.
"One down, one cigar," Bo said as she turned. He was stooping for another handful. "Where you want this one?"
"Quit it!"
She shielded herself with the bundle of bread. The second snowball plastered itself against the newspapers, and she started for him. Instead of running, as she had expected him to, he grabbed a handful of snow, and before she knew where she was, had washed her face with it.
"Keeps your complexion pretty," he said.
Sputtering, she grabbed snow and scuffled with him in the street. Mr. Blake came to the door of the post office and stood watching.
"Hey," he said mildly. "What goes on? What goes on?"
Bo crunched a snowball within 3 inches of Mr. Blake's head, and Mr. Blake retreated. Elsa, stooping, caught Bo off guard with a double handful of snow, wiped it around his face, grabbed her bread by the string, and ran. The snow melted on her face, and she wiped it off, looking back to make sure that Bo was not after her again. He stood beside the post office in a burly black dogskin coat, his teeth white in his dark face, and waved.
"Well," Helm said when she came in, "roses in the cheeks."
"That big ape of a Bo," Elsa said.
She stopped, seeing Helm's smirk.
"That explains everything," Helm said. "Don't bother to go on."
"He washed my face with snow," Elsa said. "It isn't anything like you think."
"Don't bother explaining," Helm said. "He washed your face and you're still mad. I could tell by the way you look you wouldn't speak to him on a bet."
"Oh, go to grass," Elsa said. "I brought you some bread. In a minute I'll wish I hadn't."
Still grinning, Helm waddled into the kitchen to put the bread away. When she came back, Elsa said,
"I didn't know he was sending money back to his family."
"Is he?"
"Every once in a while, they write and ask him for money, and he sends it."
"What's wrong with that?"
"Nothing, only I wish I'd known it before. I think it's nice of him."
"Oh, he's cold-blooded that way," Helm said. "Just sends money home as calmly as if he was cutting somebody's throat."
"Well, why didn't you tell me?" Elsa said. "You let me just go on."
"Couldn't anybody tell you anything last couple of weeks?" Helm said.
There was a stamping on the porch, and Bo came in his dogskin coat, looking as immense as a bear. He was whistling a bar of the Rube ballad they had heard at the carnival. He made a pass at Helm, and she lifted her great white arm.
"Feeling pretty horsey, ain't you?" she said. "Isn't anything particularly wrong, is there?" he said. "What's so right?" Helm said. "Well, the Svenska Flika has called off her dogs," Bo said.
His mouth drew down as he looked at Elsa. "Then again," he said, "Judd and me just sold 3,000 bushel of flax up 27 cents from where we bought it."
My goodness, Elsa said. That's a lot of money.
Chicken feed, Bo said. Wait till we get going.
He was so pleased with himself and the world that he couldn't keep still.
He sparred with two of Helm's boys in the kitchen, captured the pup and rolled him over to scratch his chest until the automatic hind leg was pumping, jumped up from that to go to his coat thrown over the dining table and bring out a package.
Forgot what I was going to show you, he said. How do you like this?
It was a silver shaving mug, ornately carved and molded, with a grapevine curling around the rolled brim and three heavy clusters of metal grapes hanging down from the vine. In the unornamented metal on the side was engraved, Champion of North Dakota, Singles Traps, Harry Mason, 1905.
That's lovely, Elsa said when she had looked it over. I didn't know they gave you a cup, too.
She handed it back, but he put his hands behind him.
Keep your property.
What?
It's yours. Don't you speak the English?
Take it, for God's sakes, Helm said, before you make him cry.
Bo scowled at her.
Seems to me there's an awful lot of low-class people around here, he said. How about going for a walk?
Helm stood with her hands on her hips and watched them get into their coats. She shook her head.
By God, it must be love, she said.
His hand under her elbow, Bo steered her down the beaten path in the snow.
Let's go out on the flats, he said. I've been inside so much lately I need to get some wind through me.
She lifted her skirts and plunged with him, up to her shoe tops in snow. The minute they were outside he had seemed to grow somber, and he said nothing all the way out past the last straggling shacks and into the open fields. The silence began to weigh on Elsa.
"Isn't Helm a funny old thing?" she said.
His head turned. His eyes met hers briefly. Then they looked away, ahead, anywhere, across the even white plain. Their feet found ripple-marked crust over a drift that almost held their weight, but not quite, and they staggered through it awkwardly.
"Funny," he said.
"She says such funny things," Elsa said.
"She isn't as silly as she sounds," Bo said.
They were walking across the waves of a plowed field, ribbed brown and white. A yellow cat, tender-footed, delicate, obviously disgusted at the feel of snow under its pads, obviously out of place and irritated at whatever errand took it out into the fields on such a day, crossed in front of them, stopped with a lifted forefoot, opened its mouth in a soundless mew, went delicately forward again. Bo pegged a snowball at it, and it flattened against the frozen furrow. Another, and it forgot its sensitiveness and leaped across the field in great muscular wild animal bounds.
"What on earth would a cat be doing out here?" Elsa said.
His look was sober and intent, packed with some concentrated meaning she couldn't read.
"I feel about as out of place as the cat," he said.
"Why?"
He stopped and faced her.
"I want to ask you something."
Over his dog-skin shoulder she saw the steely sky, misted, wintry, and back of him, spreading on all sides, the flat and wintry plain, spare yellow grass poking up in places swept clean by the wind, the surface irregular with miniature mounds tailed by flat cones of drift. She couldn't lift her eyes until he took her by the elbows. His hands were as rough as his voice.
"How about it?" he said.
"How about what?"
she said, refusing to let herself know what he meant.
"How about marrying me?"
Her face cold in the wind, her mind stopped by the enormity of what was happening. She looked up at him. His face was paler than she had ever seen it, and there was no foolery in it. She nodded. He moved so suddenly to kiss her that her feet tripped in the scored field, and he fell against her awkwardly. They sprawled together. Instantly the constraint was gone. Their laughter shouted into the wind, and they sat kissing exuberantly with cold lips in the middle of the waste of snow. She held him away to look at him, noticing the subtle mingling of light and dark coloring in the pupils of his eyes and the curving firmness of his mouth. Her shoulders drew up in an uncontrollable shiver. "You've got a nice mouth," she said, tracing it with her finger. "A nice mouth and dappled eyes." It seemed that afternoon, when lunch was over and they had told Carl and had decided to be married right after New Year, and Carl had gone back to the store and left them alone to plan things, that all the trouble with Sarah, her father, Indian Falls, all the sense of uprooting and homelessness, and the multiple problems that had invaded her life, were swept backward out of her mind like straw from a thresher's spout, and her world was clean and new and spotless, to be made into what she would. Bo told her that he was going to sell the pool hall. It didn't make enough money to satisfy him. Bill Consett had offered him a price, not high enough, but it might be better to take it and get that money for speculating in grain. And there was the hotel in Grand Forks that he and Judd had been looking over. With that, plus the annual pickings they could make on grain, they ought to make a pile. He would build her a house in Grand Forks as soon as things got rolling good, and meantime, if the hotel deal went through, there was always a place to live. She lay with his arm around her, thinking of that house they would build, of the lawn she would plant and the trees that would make it pleasant on warm afternoons in summer, and the roses over the trellis in front, and the hollyhocks high against a whitewashed back fence, and the grape arbor.
"Oh, goodness!" she said, and sat up suddenly. "I forgot all about that letter from Pa."
She knew what would be in it, how much his world was set against the kind of world he thought she was getting into, and she was grateful when she opened it and saw that it was in Norwegian. Bo, looking over her shoulder, couldn't read it. All he could do was snort at the spidery hand and the unfamiliar tangle of letters. Outside, the wind had risen, and pebbly snow lashed at the storm windows. Bo leaned further to see the cranky letters.
"Hen tracks," he said. "What's he say?"
"He doesn't think you're the right sort of man for me to be going around with," Elsa said. Her laugh was a little shrill, and she cut it off sharply. "He says anyone with a name like Bo is probably suspicious from the beginning. And Carl told him you ran a bowling alley. He doesn't want me to get mixed up with any rough crowd of people. Uncle Carl ought to take more care what people I know."
"Careful of you, isn't he?" Bo said.
"That isn't all," she said. "Listen. From what Carl says, I do not judge this Mason the proper sort of man for you to marry. If you insist, you will be going against my wishes. At the very least, I hope you will bring him back here for a visit before you do anything rash."
Bo was fiddling with her hand, bending the thumb, releasing it. He looked up from under his upcurved eyebrows. "What's that mean? Do we take a trip to Minnesota to get looked over?" Elsa compressed her lips. If she didn't do as she pleased now, she would never have the right of making her own decisions.
"No," she said flatly. "He hasn't any right to have a say in my affairs. We'll go right ahead and let him lump it."
"That'll mean he'll disown you, or something else nice and high-minded."
"Maybe."
He snorted. He strode to the door and threw it open. The wind whipped snow in level, driving lines across his body and through the hall.
"Go," he said, pointing with a stiff finger. "Never darken my door again."
Elsa laughed and bit her lip. "Shut the door," she said. "You'll have the hall full of snow."
"'Tis kind of blowing at that," he said.
He shut the door and came back to nuzzle in her hair.
"Does it matter much?" he said.
"It's just exactly what happened to him," she said. "He was not good enough for mother, her folks thought, and they threw her out because she insisted on marrying him. Now he acts the same way they did."
"I'm perfectly willing to go see him."
"No," she said. "He never asked any of us when he was going to marry Sarah."
"So, it's all set," Bo said. "New Year's Day."
She nodded, and his eyes crinkled in the full-lidded smile that hardly moved his lips.
Any idea how good that makes me feel?
No, she said. Tell me.
Makes me feel as if I could settle down, Beau said. Seems to me I've been on the move ever since I can remember. We'll find some good proposition and dowel ourselves in and keep our nose to the grindstone and make a pile.
Later, he said he ought to run down to the pool hall and make sure everything was Jake. He'd be back for supper if she'd let him. She kissed him long and hard at the door, clenching her fingers in the hairy coat, begrudging even the hour or so he would be gone. But he was not gone an hour. He had barely ducked into the wind, which now blew with heavy, gusty force, and she had barely settled down to look at her father's letter again when he was back, stamping the snow off his feet, his nose red and leaking, his coat stiff with the driven snow.
"This is going to be a buster," he said. "You can't see 10 feet. The old pool hall can get along by itself. Getting cold is all billy hell, too."
"Can Uncle Carl get home, do you suppose?"
"He's a sucker if he tries it."
"Maybe we ought to get fixed," she said, "if it's going to be a bad storm."
"That's why I came back," he said. "We might be marooned 3 days if this keeps on."
He shouldered his way out the kitchen door with coal scuttle and bucket. It was 5 minutes before he came back.
"By God," he said, and wiped the frozen clot from below his nose with a quick side glance of shame. "I got lost between here and the coal shed. This is an old ringtail roarer, let me tell you."
He dumped the buckets in the box and went out again, and a third time. When the box was full, he brought in another load and filled the kitchen range and the heater, went out still once more for a last pair of buckets. Then he sat down in a kitchen chair and hung out his tongue with mock exhaustion, wiping the melting snow off his forehead with the back of his hand. His laugh filled the warm kitchen.
"How about some supper, wife?"
he said. They got into aprons and played housekeeping. It was 6:30 by the time they had finished eating, and still Carl had not come. Elsa kept holding up her hand to listen for sounds. There was never anything but the pounding of the wind and the restless fluttering of the stove.
"Quit worrying," Beau said. "Carl's too wise a bird to start out in this. He'll stay snug in the store till it stops."
He was laughing, warm-eyed, the corners of his lips twitching with mirth. His big hands lay on the edge of the table before him.
"That isn't all I'm worrying about."
He leaned across the table to kiss her.
"What else?"
She forced herself to meet his eyes.
"If he doesn't come home, we'll be here together all night."
He laughed aloud.
"Why not? We're going to be married pretty soon, and nobody can talk if people get marooned in a blizzard. It happens all the time."
He came around to her, put his hands under her chin, bent over her from behind.
"It's been just like we've been married ever since this morning," he said. "Why should we worry if it keeps on?"
She shook herself loose and stood up, her chest tight and her face wrinkled as if with a pain.
"Don't blame me," she said. "Things come so fast, somehow. I seem to change my ideas about things from one day to the next."
She put her hand on his arm.
"It seems all right to me now," she said. "Honestly, it does, but can't you see what it would mean, after that letter from Pa, and the way he thinks you're not the right sort for some reason? We'd just be giving him and people like him a chance to talk and say, 'I told you so.'"
"I could slide out," Beau said. "When the storm started to let up, I could vanish."
"Would you want me to be like Eva?" she said. "Do you want to be like Judd?"
For a moment he watched her face. Then he shrugged. "All right.
But what if we can't help being cooped up here?"
"I don't know,"
she said helplessly. His laugh chopped out a short, mirthless recognition of the irony of what he had to do.
"If I get my directions crossed and come back feet first, you'll wish you'd been a little more tender-hearted," he said.
"What are you going to do?"
"Go get Carl. What do you think?"
"Bo, you can't. You'd get lost or frozen stiff."
"Probably will," he said amiably. "Got any rope around here?"
While she hung on his arm, crying that he was insane, that he wouldn't get to the corner, that she never meant he should go out into the blizzard, she didn't know what she meant.
he towed her around the kitchen, poking into cupboards and drawers for rope. He was as stubborn as a mule. He was an idiot. He would die in the storm, and then how would she feel? With a length of clothesline in his hand, he looked at her quizzically.
"When you convince me," he said, "you convince me for good."
"There must be some other way. Couldn't you go over to Konzitz? That's closer." Then her temper let loose. "Anyway, I should think you'd be able to control yourself, even if he were marooned."
He shook his head with a hanging, mocking grin.
"Wouldn't promise a thing," he said. "Us undesirable characters can't be trusted."
"All right, then," she said, and let go of his arm. "Go on out and freeze to death."
She even went into the cellar hole and found him 20 feet of rope and a length of picket chain. But when he started out the front door, he had to put his shoulder against it and heave to move the storm door through the accumulated drift. She threw herself against the dogskin coat and clung.
"Oh, be careful, Bo. If you can't find your way, don't try too long."
By now, she saw, his stubbornness and recklessness wouldn't have let him stay even if she had begged him to. He grinned, kissed her, throttled her with an enormous bear hug, put his head down, and ran. He must have run, she decided afterward, all the way to the store, taking a direction and plowing ahead blind. Probably he wanted to get there and back before she had time to worry. Probably he also wanted to impress her with how fast he could do it. She was surprised. She was even startled. The stamping came on the porch so soon. She ran to open the door. Carl, his face muffled in a felt cap with earlaps and a broad chin band with a yellow icicle in each nostril, and his eyebrows stiffly iced, stumbled in. The rope around his waist was a smooth, velvety white cable. The hall was full of wind and drift.
"Herr Gut,"
Carl said, and grabbed the storm door to keep it from blowing off its hinges. Bo loomed through the opaque, white-swirling darkness like a huge, hairy animal. When she had untied their lifeline, she led them in, inspected them under the light for signs of frostbite, rushed Bo out into the hall while she scooped up snow and held it against the leprous spots on his cheekbones. He bit at her fingers, and she slapped him on the nose.
"That's a heck of a way to welcome a guy that's just risked his neck to get a worthless old tumblebug like Carl."
"You hold still," she said.
She scrubbed his face with snow till it glowed, looked to make sure all the spots were gone, and relaxed with a noisy sigh.
"Oh, I'm glad you're back," she said,
and reached up to kiss his wet, beefy, ice-cold face right in front of Carl.
"How'd you ever make it?"
"Just spread my sails and coasted down. Wind lifted me right up and set me down square in front of the alleys. Ask Carl how we got back."
Huddling close to the stove with his neck still pulled into his shoulders, Carl grumbled.
"Ask me," he said. "Pulled me along like a steer. My belly'll be sore for a week."
Tall in the doorway, full of pride, Bo grinned at her.
"Once," he said, "Carl got off the path and started off toward Fargo somewheres. I thought he was stuck in the snow when it was only the rope caught around a telegraph pole, and I yanked him half in two before he backtracked and got straight again."
He put an icy hand on the back of Elsa's neck.
"Satisfied now?"
She squeezed the heavy muscles of his arm. Carl went into the kitchen, and she followed to get him his supper. Bo wandered after her.
"What's the use of postponing this marriage till New Year?" he said. "Why don't we get a preacher and get it over with?"
"You sound as if it was like moving furniture or something," Elsa said. "She couldn't get married in a rush like that. There wasn't anything ready. No towels, no sheets, no clothes, no anything to keep house with."
But as she looked at his cold, reddened face and his smoky, laughing eyes, and thought how nice he'd been, really, to go out in a storm like that and bring Carl back, just so she wouldn't get talked about, and because she wanted him to.
"I guess we can at least wait till the blizzard's over," she said.
It was almost the first time she had heard real mirth in his laughter, the first time it had sounded exuberant and full instead of short and half-impatient.
He pulled her onto his lap on the kitchen chair, while Carl grunted and grumbled over his supper, and scuffled with her, trying to take a toothy bite out of her between the neck and shoulder, where she was most ticklish. He was so boisterous and rough and strong that she struggled, but he held her arms and reduced her to helplessness.
"Hear that, Carl?" he said. "You can give the bride away about day after tomorrow."
"I'll be giving her away, all right," Carl said. "Might as well throw a girl to the lions."
"I'm tame," Beau said. "I'm completely housebroke. You tell him, Elsa."
"About like a dancing bear," she said. He set her suddenly on her feet and stood up.
"We have to consult the oracles," he said. "See if this marriage is going to be a success. I'll play you 11 games of casino to see who's going to wear the pants in the family. And if I win, I'll play you 11 more for the championship of the Chicago Stockyards."
Even after Carl had been long in bed and the kerosene in the parlor lamp had given out, and the lamp had dimmed, flared, sunk, flared up again, and gone out in a stink of coal oil, even after they had quit fooling around playing cards and had settled on the sofa with the rattle of granular snow on the windows and the house shuddering under the whining strength of the wind, there was a golden light over her mind, and her senses swayed with the swaying of a ghostly hammock in an idyllic grassy backyard, with hollyhocks tall against a whitewashed fence, and a redbird was nesting in the grape arbor.
Part 2 Chapter 1 In one way, the accident was a blessing. For now, after she had swept the broom awkwardly, one-handed, across the tent-house floor, had soused the dishes and set them to dry, and had stooped and pulled, making the beds, while the blood rushed painfully into her injured arm, there was good time to rest. For an hour or more in the mornings, and for long, quiet periods in the afternoons, she could sit on the plank platform before the door and let the children run in the clearing and simply relax, her mind still and her senses full of the sounds and smells that the woods had always had, but that she had never had time to notice before. Cradling her right arm, spiraled with thick bandage, in her lap, she could close her eyes and hear the tapping of woodpeckers off in the forest, and sometimes the drumming of a grouse. Her lungs loved the balsam air, and her body soaked up warmth, infinitely pleasant after the weeks of rain. It was as if a blessing had fallen suddenly on the half-acre of stumpy ground. For 5 days there had been fine weather. Every morning the sun tipped the firs and poured into the open, creeping from chip to chip until it filled the clearing, leaning its friendly weight on the tent-house door. By the time Beau went to work at 7, the shadows had all pulled themselves back toward the ring of woods, and while she did her housework she could feel the warmth growing on the canvas roof. When she handed out the carrots and greens for the 2 boys to feed to their rabbits, and came out to stand in the full sun, it was with a sense of peace and permanence so alien that she had to smile at her own perception of it. More than anything else, it was the rabbits that gave her that feeling of home. They and the children digging in the dirt around the big stump. Home, as she imagined it and remembered it, had always meant those things, children, permanence, the recurrence of monotonous and warmly felt days, and animals to care for. More than once, leaning her back against the wall, she fingered the bandage caressingly. It was odd you never realized how tired you were until something made you take a rest. Even the pain beating in her arm from wrist to elbow with a steady nagging ache was good, because it reminded her that now there was a kind of fulfillment. The pain was like something left over from the rainy winter, lying in her like the things that she could not forget. But it would pass, and the things she had thought she could never forget, she would forget. Unless she stirred too fast or got impatient at her crippling, when it would leap instantly to an immense and throbbing pressure against the tight bandage, it was even a half-pleasant kind of pain. It would pass, but the peace would not pass. While you lay against the tent wall in the sun and the children dug endlessly and happily in the dirt, Beau was working, and when the arm was better you would go back to work too, and the tent house would not always be a tent house. As you got ahead a little further, it would become a house with a barn behind at the edge of the firs, and the cafe would bring in a little money, and you could have a garden and a few animals, a cow and some chickens, and that would be a good life. In the sun, her face tipped back and her burned arm in her lap, she let down her hair and shook it over her shoulders, as thick and wavy and richly tinted as ever, lavish and rich and good to feel when it was well brushed. That was an odd thing, too. In your childhood, everybody teased you about your hair and yelled, "There comes a white horse, kid!" But now everybody seemed to think it was beautiful. You got more compliments on your hair than anything. As she brushed evenly down, pulling the hair over her breast to get at it with her good hand, she thought much about how their lives would be now, how Beau seemed to be over his disappointment and his restlessness. 7 years of hard times and the crash of 1907 had humbled his ambitions. Perhaps that was good, too. It didn't do to expect too much. It was that hotel, she thought, 5 years of butting our heads against that wall. Idly she watched a half-dozen chickadees fussily busy at a crust of bread one of the boys had dropped. Her brush handle lay smooth and rounded and solid in her hand. She felt it there, something she could put down if she chose, but she did not put it down. She liked its solid, familiar feel. That was the way with things you remembered. You could put them down if you chose, but you didn't quite choose. Every once in a while you took them up and found them familiar and well-worn and intimate, and you kept them where you could touch them when you wanted to. But that hotel, there was little you wanted to remember about that. The musty smell of the halls, the unpleasant work of cleaning rooms after the bank went and the help had to be let go, the unfriendly masculine atmosphere of the lobby with its faint, sour smell of whiskey from the bar that had gone in spite of her protests. How can you run a commercial hotel without a bar? It was funny, but the things you felt most vividly about that hotel, even more vividly than you felt the birth of Chester and Bruce in the first-floor front suite where you lived, even more than you felt the loss of the first one, the girl baby born dead, were the evenings when Beau played solitaire, and the time Pinky Jordan came around. Those things had weight in the memory. Those were what was left when you boiled down 6 years in your mind. The solitaire grew on him slowly in the days when receipts and expenses chased each other in an endless circle, and the big companies took their drummers off the road and the bank had been cleaned out. It became a ritual, a kind of intent, solitary fortune-telling game. Every evening he sat down at the table with cards and a tablet and pencil. The game never varied. He bought the deck for $52 and got back 5 for every card he put up. For hours some nights she heard the stiff riffle of cards, the slipping noise as he thumbed the deck, the light smack as he laid them down. Looking up she saw his dark, intent face, dark even in winter, bent over the game. When the last card was gone he leaned over and added figures to the long string on the tablet, adding or subtracting from his total gain or loss. Then the riffle again, the expert flip of the cut, the light smack of a new layout going down. Sometimes, cleaning up, she looked with baffled wonder at the columns of figures on a discarded tablet sheet, the thousands of dollars of mythical debt, and once in a while at top or bottom of a string of aimless figures, elaborately penman-like, neat sevens and nines and twos with curly tails, or signatures with strong flowing downstrokes. Harry G. Mason. Harry G. Mason. 7777722222299999. And the debt going up in fantastic figures from page to page. She learned to know that whenever the aimless signatures and the strings of numbers appeared on the pages, he was more baffled and restless and prowling and dissatisfied than usual, that somebody had ducked on his bill, or that he and Judd had lost money in a poker game in the room behind the bar. It did no good to laugh at him or get mad at him. He wanted, he said, to see how much he would stand to make from a solitaire game if he ever had a gambling house. When she asked him if he were planning on starting a gambling house, he said no, of course not. But he wanted to know. She knew that he attached cabalistic importance to his figures. If he made money off his game one night, that meant that the next day the bar would do a good business, or there would be a couple more rooms rented. If he lost, the next day would be bad. So he did his best never to lose. He would play 5 games more just to see if he couldn't pick it up. When he lost on those, he would play 5 more, and then 10 more, and then 15 more, just to make it an even 50 games for the evening. And if he had a string of games in which he did not win at all, he became angry and intent and touchy, and went to bed angrily, leaving cards and tablet sheets scattered over the table. When he finally threw the deck down one night and said he had lost $56,000 on 5,000 games, she thought he might be over that streak. But the next night he was playing solitaire cribbage, with the purpose, he said, of determining exactly what the average crib hand was. But cribbage, too, he used like a crystal ball. If he won as often as he lost, then the hotel would pull out of it and be a decent proposition. If he lost 75 out of 100 games, it was a washout. They might as well sell it tomorrow or give it away. If he won 75 out of 100, they'd make a mint. She shook her head and smiled, remembering that. She couldn't remember how it had ended. So many evenings were blended into one composite recollection that she didn't know for sure whether he had been playing solitaire up to the time Pinky Jordan came to town, or whether he had stopped of his own accord. All she knew was that by the time Pinky Jordan came, the hotel was a hopeless weight on their backs, that even Judd was getting the look of failure and defeat, that it seemed to her now lay like mildew over all of them. And Eva, still living with Judd in the hotel, not married but going by the name of Mrs. Chain, having attacks of her gallbladder trouble, or whatever it was that ailed her, and needing attention like an invalid half the time. They were all tired out and low when Pinky Jordan came. Perhaps that was why he seemed like a comet across their horizon. That day Elsa remembered as clearly as if it had been last week. "And why not?" she said. "If it hadn't been for him, we wouldn't be here in Washington now. We wouldn't have gone back to Indian Falls that winter. We wouldn't have done anything, probably, except go on trying to make the hotel pay. Why wouldn't I remember an afternoon that changed our whole lives?" At the end of an opaque, telescoped gap in her life, there was a little man with a nicked ear and a whiskey voice, a kind of Pied Piper, who whistled one tune, and up came all the roots of the people who heard him. She was sitting in the chair behind the desk, resting after putting the children away for their naps, and trying not to hear the random talk that came through the door of the Blind Pig, brazenly, halfway open because of the heat. Chester had been down before going to bed, and Beau had swatted him with buggy pillows and tickled him into spasms, and had ended by setting him on the bar and giving him a sip of beer. When she sailed in and rescued him, Beau had been disgusted, almost nasty. "Oh, for God's sakes," he said. "What's the harm in that?" Judd, tending bar, winked at her and raised his shoulders eloquently. A couple of drummers had laughed. Then, as she sat behind the desk, the screen door of the lobby opened, and a little hatless, bald-headed man came in. His face was a fiery rose pink, and his bald red scalp was scrawled with bluish veins above the temples. His breath, when he leaned confidentially toward her, almost knocked her down. His voice was a whiskey voice. She had learned to recognize that.
"I was told," said his hoarse whisper, "that a man could get a drink in here."
She jingled the bell for Beau, not even bothering to deny that they served liquor, as she ordinarily would have. This man was obviously no officer, but only a tramp or barfly wandering in on his way through town. Beau came hurriedly to the door, looked the man over, and motioned him inside. The door he left ajar. She heard the clump of a bottle on the bar, and a low mutter of talk. Shortly the whiskey voice rose.
"I'll have another one of those."
Altogether he ordered 5 drinks in the course of an hour, in his hoarse, commanding whisper. The dead summer afternoon drifted on. A boy going past opened and slammed the screen door just to hear the noise.
"Give me another one,"
said the whiskey voice from the bar. Drowsily, without much interest, but with nothing else to occupy her attention, she heard Beau come over and set one up for the stranger, as he always did when anyone was buying freely. After a time, the whiskey voice said,
"How much, barkeep?"
Judd's voice said, "$1.75," and change clinked on the bar.
"Ain't got the change," the whiskey voice said. "You got a gold scale?"
"Hell no," Judd said, and laughed. "What for?"
"This is all I got with me."
There was a sodden thump on the wood, and for once Elsa heard excitement and haste in Judd's voice. "I'll be damned," he said. "Hey, Bo, this guy wants to pay off in gold dust." But the rapid steps, the noise of crowding, the exclamations were at the bar almost as soon as he started to speak. "Where in hell did you get that?" Bo said.
"Klondike," said the superior, bored, whiskey voice. "If that's any of your business."
"No offense, no offense," Bo said. "We just don't see any of that around here. Pan it yourself?"
"Right out of the gravel, boys."
He must have poured some into his palm, for there were whistles and exclamations. Elsa strained her ears, but she needn't have. The men in the pig were almost shouting.
"Jumping, Jesus,"
a drummer said. "How much is that poke worth?"
"Oh, 500, 600.
"Quite a slug to be lugging around," Beau said.
"More where that came from,"
the stranger said.
"Plenty more salted away, boys. Never carry more than a need."
"I'll go try the drugstore for a scale," Bo said. "How much an ounce?"
$18.
Bo laughed, a short, incredulous chop of sound. "You have to spend your money with an eyedropper at that rate." Pinky Jordan stayed all afternoon to soak up the admiration he had aroused. After she had brought the baby down in his buggy and set Chester to playing with his blocks, Elsa heard scraps of the tales he was holding his listeners with. Three more men had come back with Beau from the drugstore, and all afternoon others kept dropping in to have a beer and listen to stories of hundreds of miles of wild timberland, hundreds of thousands of caribou, hundreds of millions of salmon in suicidal dashes up the rivers, of woods full of bear and deer and otter and fox and wolverine and mink, of fruit salads on every tree in berry time. You didn't need to work for a living. You picked it off the bushes, netted it out of the river, shot it out of the woods, panned it out of the gravel in your front yard.
"You know how much a friend of mine got for one silver fox skin?"
the whiskey voice was saying as she drew near the door once with the broom as an excuse.
"For one little skin?"
The voice was confidential and dramatic.
$400.
There were whistles, clickings against the teeth.
$400, Pinky Jordan said, and he traded it out of a half-breed for a flannel shirt and a sheath knife. You want to make your fortune, gentlemen? You go on up to God's country, flowing with milk and honey.
It was nearly supper time when Pinky Jordan, drunk on his own eloquence and the uncounted drinks his listeners had poured for him, wobbled out of the lobby. Bo was at his elbow, telling him confidentially that sometimes they got up a little game in the evenings. Be glad to have him drop in. Just a friendly little game, no high stakes, but pleasant. They'd be glad to have him. Pinky Jordan nodded owlishly, winked both eyes, so that his naked red scalp pulled down over his brows like a loose-slipping skull cap. From the desk, Elsa watched him in the horizontal light of evening, hesitating on the front sidewalk, a little man with a red, bald head and a nick out of his right ear as if someone had taken a neat bite from it. Then he started up the walk, kicking at a crumpled piece of paper. Each time he came up behind it, measured his kick, booted it a few feet, and staggered after it to measure and kick again. On the fourth kick, he stubbed his toe and fell into the street, and the men who had been looking after him from lobby and sidewalk ran to set him straight again. He jerked his kingly elbows out of their hands and staggered out of sight. Pinky Jordan never returned for the poker game, though Bo tried all the next day to locate him around town. But he had done his work. He left behind him a few dollars' worth of gold dust in a shot glass behind Beau Mason's bar. He also left behind him a vision of clean wilderness, white rivers and noble mountains, forests full of game and fabulously valuable fur, sand full of glittering grains. And he left in Beau, fretted by hard times and the burden of an unpaid mortgage, and the worry and wear of keeping his nose too long to an unprofitable grindstone, a heightened case of that same old wandering itch that had driven him from town to town and job to job since he was 14. He was born with an itch in his bones, Elsa knew. He was always telling stories of men who had gone over the hills to some new place and found a land of Canaan, made their pile, got to be big men in the communities they fathered. But the Canaans toward which Beau's feet had turned had not lived up to their promise. People had been before him. The cream, he said, was gone. He should have lived 100 years earlier. Yet he would never quite grant that all the good places were filled up. There was somewhere, if you knew where to find it, some place where money could be made like drawing water from a well. Some big rock candy mountain where life was effortless and rich and unrestricted and full of adventure and action, where something could be had for nothing. He hadn't found it in Chicago or Milwaukee or Terre Haute or the Wisconsin woods or Dakota. There was no place and no business where you took chances and the chances paid off, where you played and the play was profitable. Ball playing might have been it, if he had hit the big time. But bad luck had spoiled that chance. But in the Klondike, Elsa knew, as soon as he opened his mouth to say something when Pinky Jordan was gone, was the real thing, the thing he had been looking for a lifetime. "Let me show you," he said, and brought the shot glass containing Pinky Jordan's immortal dust. His mind was white-hot with visions, and he vibrated like a harp to his own versions of Pinky's yarns. There was a place without these scorching summers that fried the meat on your bones. There was a place where banks didn't close and panics didn't reach, where they had no rules and regulations a man had to live by. You stood on your own 2 feet and to hell with the rest of the world. In the Klondike, the rivers ran gold, and silver foxskins fetched $400 apiece, and the woods were full of them. She was not surprised when he proposed selling the hotel and lighting out. It took him only 3 or 4 days to arrive at that plan, but she was ready for it. "Do you know what time of year it is?" she said. His look was suspicious, as if he suspected her of plotting to throw hindrances in his path. "It doesn't take an astrologer to know it isn't Christmas," he said, and ran a finger inside the sweating band of his collar.
"No," she said, "but by the time you sell this place and get to Seattle and take a boat to Alaska or wherever it is you go, it will be Christmas."
His look this time was as heavy as a hand pushing against her. "What of it?"
"I believe you'd take those 2 little kids up there right in the dead of winter," she said.
"Winter's the fur season. Judd and I could go out trapping and you and the kids could stay in town."
"Is Judd going?"
"Sure, if we do. He's all hot to go."
"Eva, too?"
"I suppose."
"So you've got it all planned," she said. "It's nice of you to come and tell me about it.
Don't you want to go? Do you want to sit around here, growing roots in your tail in this damned old hotel all your life?"
"That isn't it," she said. "I'm thinking about the kids."
"Yeah," he said gloomily. "Well, I don't know. Probably we couldn't move this joint with a derrick anyway." But circumstances pushed them faster than they would have pushed themselves. Beau had just got her promise that she would go to Alaska in the spring if they could move the hotel during the winter, when the police raided them, closed the blind pig, jailed Judd and missed Beau only because he was out of the hotel at the time, and ducked out of town when he heard. Within 2 weeks of Pinky Jordan's meteoric passage, Elsa and the 2 children were on their way to Indian Falls, going back ignominiously to the home she had run away from 6 years before, accepting whatever stiff charity her father's letter offered. It was Beau who wrote in from where he was staying in a soddy with a homesteader and suggested that armistice with Indian Falls.
Now it was a cinch they'd have to get out of the hotel, and they'd need all the money they could scrape together for passage in the spring. Couldn't they stay on her old man's farm, maybe, and earn their keep helping run the place?
Elsa made a bitter face and ruffled the bristles in her hairbrush, trying to decide how she ever humbled herself enough for that surrender, how Beau could have suggested it. It was the dream of what they would do in the spring, she supposed, the fire of that optimism melting everything else down until the only important thing was to get to the promised land. She supposed he would have stolen and cheated and lied to get there. When he slipped aboard the train 100 miles out of Grand Forks and slid into the seat beside her, he did not mention where they were going, or remark on how mean it was to come sneaking back after defiance and repudiation to accept as charity what you had once refused as your right. All he said, breathing on the glass and rubbing the place clean to see out of, was that, by God, he'd never been gladder to get out of any place than he was to get out of that hotel. The hairbrush slipped from her knees, and her quick jerk to catch it set the blood to throbbing in her arm. Carefully, with a morbid curiosity about what it looked like today, she unwrapped the bandage. The sight of the arm outraged her, and the smell made her wrinkle her nose in disgust. From above her elbow to her fingers, the arm was one red piece of butcher's meat, spotted with watery blisters. At the wrist, the bandage stuck, and she yanked it loose. Blood oozed in beady droplets from the skinned flesh. It didn't feel better with the bandage off. It felt worse. But somewhere she had read that sunshine was good for hurts of any kind, and so every day she exposed it. A burn was a nasty kind of injury, she thought, inflamed and disgusting. Once she had been proud of her arms, but when she stretched them out together now, the one hard, round, white, the other a peeled monstrosity, she grimaced. Maybe it never would look right again. She turned the other arm over, studying its fitness, and saw a slightly chapped spot on the elbow. She must get some cold cream to put on that. She didn't want elbows like Harriet Conzett's, or a goat's knees, or Sarah's. The last time she saw Sarah, she had been like a walking waxwork, submerged, buried, slipping into middle age before she had ever been young.
"I'm only 26, Elsa thought. "That isn't old. And maybe now we'll all be settled down and get a house built sometime, and the boys will grow up and go to school. I've got at least 40 years ahead of me," she thought. It seemed a wonderful and dangerous idea. She contemplated it, shaking her head and smiling before she got clean bandage and rewrapped her arm and got up to make the children their dinner. Chapter 2 The boys had been long in bed when she heard Beau's steps on the path and rose to pull the curtain closer around their bed and turn up the lamp. She heard the scuff of his soles on the foot scraper. He was always careful about tracking in mud. Then the door swung inward, and he came in with a lantern in his hand, a package under the other arm. As he lifted the chimney and blew out the lantern, his big body blocked the door.
"You're late tonight," she said. "Any business?"
"Chicken feed."
"How's your arm?"
"Pretty good."
"Been picking at it any more?"
"Some more skin came off."
At his frown, she added defensively, "It just peels off in sheets. I can't leave it there."
"What'd you take the bandage off for?"
"It feels better."
He dumped the package on the table, keeping one hand on it.
"You deserve to get blood poison," he said. "Let the doc take the skin off if it needs taking off."
"I was just sitting out in the sun. It felt so tight I unrolled the bandage, and there was that loose skin, so I just snipped it off."
He looked at her and shook his head as if defeated.
"Have you eaten anything?" she said.
"I ate before I closed up."
"Well, what happened today?"
she said, and settled back comfortably on the bed.
This was the way it should be. It should be warm and pleasant and home-like like this, with your husband coming home from work and everything snug for the night and plenty of time to talk. Only it was a shame he had to work such long hours now that she was laid up.
She saw his hand still protective on the package, and his eyes secret and sly.
"What have you got there?" she said.
"Been bargain hunting."
"What is it?"
"Bombs," he said,
and moved the package away from her reaching hand. I joined the IWWs. With a quick grab, she hooked her fingers in the string. Let me see. Look out, it might go off. Well, quit your fooling and let me see. He surrendered the parcel and watched her, grinning, while she undid the string. Save the store cording, he said, and she rolled the string into a coil before unwrapping the package. Inside was a set of books in a red marbled binding, with dark red leather on spines and corners. Complete works of Shakespeare, the lettering on the spine said. Uncertainly, she opened one and looked inside. It looked expensive. Well, Beau said, where on earth did you get them?
Fella came around. Selling Bibles, mainly, but I didn't think you'd want a Bible.
Under her fingers, the leather was smooth and cool. How much? She said.
What does that matter? Do you like them or don't you?
Of course I like them. Her voice was low, but I bet you paid more than we can afford for them.
Beau picked up one of the books and hefted it appreciatively, cracked back the spine in a way that would have infuriated her father, who always went through a book page by page, pressing down the sheet so as not to break the binding.
Well, hell, he said, I'm sick of not having anything decent around. We've got to have some books around the place, kids growing up and everything. I'd like to have a whole room full.
She read him as plain as daylight. He was afraid he had been stung. He was scared she wouldn't like them. He knew he had been extravagant, but just suggest that the book peddler had skinned him and he'd blow up like a bullfrog.
A room full of books and a tent, she said, before she thought.
Then she saw that he was hurt and got up and hugged him around the neck.
I love them, she said. It was sweet of you to think of getting me something.
He pulled her down on his lap.
I don't like living in a tent any better than you do, he said.
That's funny, she said, relaxing against him. Since I got burned, I'd loved it. Everything's been so settled and quiet, it's like home all of a sudden.
Through his shirt, his body was like a stove. She felt warm and comfortable, cradled in affection so sure and easy that she rubbed against him.
You've been so nice lately, she said. It's like it used to be before our luck got bad.
It sure isn't any better now, he said.
And she felt his body stir irritably.
I can't understand why that joint don't make money. It ought to, but it don't.
It makes some.
Some isn't enough.
Isn't it? She said, pulling herself back to look in his face. Isn't it enough to make a living and get ahead gradually and make sure of things one after another and settle down in one place?
It'd be all right if you could make enough to live like a human being.
It's slow, she said, but we do make a little all the time, Beau. We'll have the fixtures paid for in a few more months, and then we'll make more. If we're careful, we'll be all right in a year.
He grunted.
Being careful is what makes my tail ache. You get kind of sick being careful after a while.
Oh, we'll make it, she said. As soon as I'm well, I'll take over, and you can sleep for a week. You're all tired out.
I'm not tired out. I'm just sick of that dinky little lumber town and seeing the same guys across the counter week in and week out.
When we get the installments paid off, we can hire somebody, maybe, she said. She kissed the side of his face. Beau, she said, you know you haven't got mad at either of the kids for a week?
He grunted, but good-naturedly.
Must have forgot. I'll take care of it tomorrow.
You watch them, she said. They're three times better when they don't get punished a lot. They're as sweet as pie all day.
His wide chest swelled and sank under her.
Yeah, I suppose. It's been so long since I saw either of them, I'll have to be introduced all over again.
You are all worn out, she said. I'll hurry up and get well so you can have a rest. Suddenly, weakly, she wanted to cry. She put her face against him and laughed instead.
What's the matter?
I don't know. I'm just so happy things are as good as they are, even. After what happened in Seattle, I guess I didn't ever think I could feel happy again.
She smiled into his warming, half-closed eyes and hugged him with her good arm.
Did you know you're a darling sometimes?
I've been told so,
Beau said comfortably.
What am I darling about now?
Just being you, she said. Just being the nice you.
Her eyes went down to the book he still held in one hand.
Bo?
What?
As if he were methodically ringing doorbells, his fingers went down her back, pushing each vertebra.